welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This month we celebrate the 200th birthday of the nation's largest library, the Library of Congress, the depository of some of America's greatest literary achievements, valuable historical records, and much more. In a moment, Talking History's Dennis Mihalik will speak with James Conaway, the author of A New History of the Library of Congress. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Although a committed pacifist for most of his life, during this week in 1932, physicist Albert Einstein called for the nations of the world to stop, with military force if necessary, what he identified as the monstrous inhumanities being committed by Nazi Germany. He issued his statement when he arrived in the United States, having fled his German homeland. Once in the United States, Einstein received several offers from the nation's leading colleges and universities, finally accepting the position at the newly established Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. He urged President Franklin Roosevelt to take action against the Nazis and to prepare for war by developing the world's first atomic bomb, something he knew the Germans were already engaged in creating. He also continued his research in physics, much of which was useful in America's Manhattan Project. After the war and the defeat of Nazi Germany, Einstein returned to the pacifist sentiments he once expressed, lending his support to an international nuclear disarmament movement. Turning to history in the news, in a decision that some believe jeopardizes the possibility of researchers unlocking mysteries about some of the earliest inhabitants of North America, the U.S. Interior Department recently ordered officials to relinquish control of the skeletal remains of Kennewick Man to five Native American tribes that claim him as their ancestor. The decision comes 4 years after anthropologists found the 9,000-year-old remains in the Pacific Northwest. Many scientists say that Kennewick Man's bones may hold the secret of how the first nomads reached the New World, which may not have been across a land bridge connecting Russia and Alaska, as long believed. The Virginia Military Institute recently added yet another piece of World War II memorabilia to its already renowned collection. Last month, two collectors from Beverly Hills, California, donated to VMI the original teletype message from General Dwight Eisenhower that announced Nazi Germany's surrender. The memo was received by Army Lieutenant Bob Fitchenberg in France, who forwarded the message to field commanders but kept the original for himself. Decades later, Fitchenberg's brother found it in a service footlocker in his mother's attic and put it up for auction. The purchasers, after paying $5,000 for it, gave it to VMI. You are listening to Talking History. A nation cannot survive without a memory of its past, and the leading depository of the record of the American past is the Library of Congress. Here to explore the 200-year history of the Library of Congress is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. This year, the Library of Congress has celebrated its 200th birthday. Here to provide some historical perspective on this venerable institution is James Conaway, the author of America's Library, The Story of the Library of Congress, 1800 through 2000, published by the Yale University Press in association with the Library of Congress. Welcome, Mr. Conaway.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the obvious. I mean, why did Congress want or need a library?
Well, Congress is concerned with passing laws, and in the best of all worlds, laws are passed based upon fact, not just politics. And I think early on, the Continental Congress determined that they needed some sort of reference books to be able to go to when they needed facts. And this, the Library of Congress, before it was formally established, actually goes back to a collection of books of various sorts, just a very small collection that was used for reference.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, where was it located?
Well, it was first in New York City, but it didn't exist as the Library of Congress at the time. That's when the Congress first met, or the provisional government met and then, of course, moved to Philadelphia, which was the first site of Congress. And their collection of books grew there as well, but it still wasn't called, it wasn't an official entity. It wasn't until the Congress was established in Washington, D.C., that the attention turned to a serious library, meaning one that had extensive capability for providing facts and figures for members of Congress, and the idea that the library should be something more than this was Thomas Jefferson's course. And once Jefferson, who was, that we all know, a great scholar and man of words, got hold of the idea, it began to be something else entirely. And that, to me, was always the interesting part of the story, because Jefferson, the ghost of Jefferson, the reality and the ghost of Jefferson moves in and out of the creation of the Library of Congress, and still, to this day, informs what the library is.
Okay, well, let's deal with the reality of it then. I mean, during the War of 1812, just after Jefferson's presidency, the British sacked the United States Capitol. Did that damage the library?
It certainly did. But if I could, and let me back up just a little bit here. When the library was formally established in 1800, and Jefferson pushed for buying books in England and abroad as well as in this country, because in 1800 the availability of good, extensive libraries was quite limited. Even in that day, some members of Congress objected to spending any money at all on books, and the usual kind of objections were raised that have sort of have echoed through the years. But Jefferson persisted. The library was founded. It was housed in Congress between the two houses, between the House and the Senate, and it served there as a source of information for staff and also for congressmen and senators. Okay. At this time, it was a fairly limited library, but by the standards of a young nation, it was not limited. It was big. It occupied one very large room that had balconies and ways of walking around it, and was considered an attraction, kind of a tourist attraction. People came to look at it. All right, then during the invasion of 1812, as you know, the British came up from the Chesapeake and invaded the city and burned Congress, in part in retaliation for American troops burning a building, congressional building, or a government building in Canada earlier. And when they burned the Capitol, they severely damaged the library, and in fact destroyed most of the works that were in it. So that, after all the problems that had existed establishing the library in the first place and bringing this collection together, this small triumph of the library was destroyed. An interesting thing had happened, though, in the interim. Jefferson had retired, had gone back to Monticello. He had had a very hard political career. He still had enemies in Congress and outside of Congress, and he was also very close to being bankrupt, because he had extravagant habits, as you know, with regard to architecture and other things. He spent a lot of money on changing Monticello and other things, experiments, whatever, and he just didn't have that money. And he had a lot of debt. But what he also had at Monticello was a wonderful library, the best library that existed in the United States, his personal library, to which he had contributed all of his life, starting from the time he was a student, when he was an ambassador in France, and so on, while he was the president. And the proposal was made to restart, to jumpstart the Library of Congress, so to speak, that Congress in the United States should purchase this very extensive, very good, very expensive by standards then library, to be the basis of an ongoing, growing Library of Congress. The beauty of that, from the point of view of anyone who loves Thomas Jefferson, and the idea of him is that it was able, his books were, if this was okayed by Congress, this library, this wonderful library, would pass to posterity, American posterity, and would not be broken up after his death, which undoubtedly would have happened. And also, the Congress, and could be the instrument of the American people, their tax money, whatever, would go to help an old man who needed financial help desperately in his final years. So as you can imagine, his enemies tried to prevent this, but his friends were for it, and eventually it passed. And his library was purchased, and he received enough money to pay off most of his debts and to live a comfortable old age until he died. And those books were transported from Monticello to Washington, D.C. in wagons. He had cases specially built. I wish those had survived that held the books. They were loaded onto wagons. This whole wagon train came up with the books, thousands of volumes from Monticello. And they had to ford several rivers in these wagons to get the books to the library, to Washington, D.C., so it was quite an event, quite a dramatic passage, and it all had a wonderful effect.
Now, these cases, I mean, did he make waterproof cases?
No, they weren't waterproof.
They weren't?
Cases.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the wagons weren't floating in the rivers, but
right.
My point is that these are small rivers in the mm-hmm. Virginia Piedmont, but they still had to go through water. You know, it was a rough journey over rough roads, and he had these cases, these wooden cases specially made at Monticello just for the passage, just for transporting these books. And it was an ordeal and a kind of an event. And when they arrived here, they went into the, back into the refurbished Library of Congress, which was still in the Capitol building itself, where it remained for years, but during the administration of Ainsworth Rand Spofford, who was one of the librarians of Congress, probably the most renowned librarian in Congress, certainly of the early ones, he was constantly pushing for a new building because they didn't have room for these books. At this point, they had Jefferson's library, plus they had everything else that they had accumulated, and books soon overwhelmed this very large gallery in the Capitol and had to be stacked on the floor. And Spofford he complained about this and pushed and pushed and pushed for a separate building to be built. And finally, congressmen, senators, and their aides were having so much trouble getting around these piles of books and finding what they needed to find that they okayed the expenditure of money to build what is now known as the Library of Congress. It's the one we all know that's just there, just east of the Capitol. On the corner, it's called the Jefferson Building. It's one of three buildings of the official Library of Congress today, but it's the ornate, the beautiful building built with classical design, classical proportions that we all know of as the Library of Congress. And it was appropriately named after Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say the ghost of Jefferson. How is Jefferson's ghost out there still influencing the Library of Congress?
Well, I meant that in the sense that his whole idea of knowledge was not something that was static. It was not just facts and figures. It contained elements of the American imagination, all imagination. It was limitless. This notion that he said at one point that there was no subject imaginable that a member of Congress might not someday need to have knowledge of. And by expanding on this idea, taking this idea to its logical conclusion, the library became not just a warehouse, not just a storage bin, but an institution that was devoted to human thought, to the human imagination, whatever ramifications that might be. And it is that notion that led the library to begin to collect everything that people there felt was important. Obviously, American intelligence, American imagination, American works are clearly at the forefront, but it really is an institution that embraces all knowledge, as indeed Thomas Jefferson did.
Mm-hmm. Now, we also know Jefferson as a founder of the American democracy. And, of course, at least in my mind as a scholar, I think of the Library of Congress not as a library for Congress, but as a national library. Did Jefferson have this idea?
I think in the sense that it embodied the best of American thought, he did. I think he also saw it as a point of origin of information and a resource for all the people. Whether or not Thomas Jefferson ever envisioned that the library would be what it is today, I can't say. But you're right, it is America's library. And it surprises some people, many people who use it actually, that its genesis lay in the needs of Congress and that it was totally dependent upon Congress for its existence, still is for that matter, although it has taken on a life of its own now. But in the early days, there were some people who thought the library, some people in Congress who thought the library was a waste of time, that they could get whatever they needed out of the Farmer's Almanac or the Dictionary. That obviously is the other side of the coin. But it has, when you think about it, Congress is also an institution of the people of the United States. It's the people's government, supposedly, and it's quite fitting that the library would be the people's library as well, but mm-hmm. libraries and knowledge are bigger than politicians and political impulses. And
mm-hmm. So when did the people then get the right to use that library?
Well, the people had the right to drop in and browse and look around for quite a while. The use of it by scholars was, there is no clear point where that took place. It was an incremental thing, just like the notion to start collecting at the library all manner of things that are relevant to human knowledge and some people think are irrelevant. That was also an incremental decision and came in part through the various librarians and their qualified staff realizing that the library's very existence and the way that it operated exposed it to many treasures, both books, artwork, things like that that wouldn't commonly come to the view of collectors. And gradually, this was determined to be a worthwhile thing to do, and things have sort of progressed from there. Now the library. It's interesting, in the electronic age we've entered, the library was pretty much avant-garde there, I think, in trying to get as much things online, get things computerized as quickly as possible. And there are many people who at the library, including the current librarian, Dr. Billington, who see the library as a kind of refuge for knowledge and culture and times so that when these things are not so much in favor, they will still flourish and reside and flourish at the Library of Congress, and then in later ages, when if this comes back, there'll still be this wonderful resource of language and all the things that go with it. And there are other libraries in the past that have, the Alexandrian Library and others, that have performed the same function for civilization ever since there's been the written word.
Well, I want to thank you. That's all the time we have. I thank our guest, James Conway, author of America's Library, The Story of the Library of Congress, published by Yale University Press.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, they can't take that away from me. The way you smile just beams, the way you sing our key, the way you haunt my dreams.
For our op-ed of the week, we offer a tribute to the Library of Congress by the President of the American Library Association, Nancy Cronick. Cronick also serves as Associate Dean of Libraries at New York University.
If any institution represents the ideal of American democracy, it is the Library of Congress. Founded in 1800, the vision for the library was outlined by its principal sponsor, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson believed that the power of the intellect should be the driving force in the creation of a free and democratic society. He also believed that the national legislature needed ideas and information on all topics and in many languages in order to govern a democracy successfully. Today's Library of Congress, the largest repository of recorded knowledge on Earth, epitomizes Jefferson's faith in learning and his practical determination to make democracy work. Indeed, the library serves as a symbol of American democracy and its faith in the power of learning. When Benjamin Franklin became Librarian of Congress in the late 1980s, he launched several major digital projects with the Jeffersonian purpose to increase the knowledge available to Americans in their local communities. Billington's determination to extend the reach and influence of the Library of Congress is very much in the ambitious tradition of his predecessors. Alone among the world's great libraries, the Library of Congress still attempts to be a universal library, collecting materials of research value in almost all languages and media. Entering its third century, the Library of Congress is still guided by Thomas Jefferson's belief that democracy depends on knowledge. As the Library of Congress enters the 21st century, its legacy is well captured in James Billington's own words. He said, "The unleashed, unlimited pursuit of truth may be the last frontier and the ultimate proving ground for the American ideal of freedom. In a world of increasing physical restraints and limitations, it is only in the life of the mind and spirit that the horizons of freedom can remain truly infinite. We must rediscover what we should have known all along, that the pursuit of truth is the noblest of Jefferson's legacy." On behalf of librarians throughout the country, I salute you. Happy birthday, Library of Congress. Happy 200th birthday. Just imagine what another century will bring.
You've been listening to Nancy Cronick, President of the American Library Association. This is Talking History. It goes without saying that the Library of Congress, which is more than just a research library, would be our site of the week. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Visiting the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. can be an all-day affair. It's certainly more than just a room full of books. There are many permanent and visiting exhibits on display, and currently the Library of Congress is hosting a major exhibit of the 50 years of editorial cartoons by Herb Block, which runs until February 17th of 2001. One of the most popular permanent exhibits is the George and Ira Gershwin Room, which displays materials from the library's Gershwin collection. There is the American Treasures Collection, which showcases 240 items that represent the breadth and the depth of the library's historical collection. There are symposiums and concerts throughout the year. For more information, contact the Library of Congress or visit them on the web for a complete listing of events.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, it's time again to test your knowledge of American history. On December 15th, Barry Bostwick will host another segment of the History Channel's The Great American History Quiz. Among the areas tested will be American folklore and symbolism. from Uncle Sam to Apple Pie, this all-new addition to the popular quiz program will reach into the red, white, and blue nostalgia bag for a fun-filled look at all things American. Viewers are invited to play along at home and to download a free quiz show score sheet at the History Channel's homepage, historychannel.com. On December 18th, watch for the History Channel's The FBI Celebrity Files. J. Edgar Hoover gathered information and kept files on a large number of celebrities who did not subscribe to his moral and political code. Those files have now been opened to the public, and you can see what Hoover learned about the likes of Abbott and Costello, John Lennon, George Carlin, Frank Sinatra, and Jacques Cousteau. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll talk about the history of Lithuania's independence movement with two of its leading figures. Until next time, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. ¶¶